I do not want to live like this. I would freak out.
Welcome, Lindsay L.
I'm like trying to embrace my body and embrace my body image, but it's hard. If I were to sit here and be like, I am healed, it would be such a lie because I'm not. Me feeling sad when I open up Instagram, trigger. Me feeling less about myself when I open up Instagram, triggered. To this day, my whole body is like, ah!
I can't believe someone would say that, A. B, I'm so glad this person is your ex.
Me too. Okay, well, this makes me feel so good. So doing
5 hours.
It is going to make me feel even better.
Right.
Like, does that sound like an addict or what?
It absolutely does. And I absolutely have been there.
And so the more we get to know ourselves, the more we get to learn like what makes us happy and what brings us joy and what surrounds us with love. And the more we get to design the lives of our dreams.
Welcome to this episode of Rooted Recovery Stories. I'm Patrick Custer. So excited each and every one of you are here. I've got a super, super special person I'm so excited to talk to today. She is a phenomenal country music artist, award-winning, and the host of Canada's Got Talent. Welcome, Lindsay L.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It's so good to be here.
Absolutely. Currently, right now, it is snowy wonderland here in Nashville, Tennessee, where we're
filming. It is.
Filming.
Yeah. Snowmageddon, as some of my friends refer to it as. I grew up in Canada, so I am no, you know, stranger to the snow, but it's just different when it snows down here. You know, right. We have like one truck for the whole entire city. So icy roads are a real thing.
Yeah. Well, and I would say too, many of our lovely citizens aren't used to or educated on how, you know, to make sure you don't have ice chunks on your car that are going to fly off on the interstate.
Totally.
And, you know.
Yeah, or they don't know how to drive on ice or loose snow. So it's kind of like you're playing bumper cars out there.
Yeah.
It's like defensive driving left, right, and center. Yeah, it's pretty wild.
It's interesting. So we've made it through. I mean, I feel like the melting is coming soon. I don't know.
Like it's coming soon. Yeah. Thankfully.
By the time this airs, hopefully we'll have green grass showing. And
I know. It'll be like 65 degrees again.
Yeah. The weather in Nashville is so crazy. Is the weather where you're from, does it jump back and forth like it does here so
yeah,
quickly?
Yeah. Where I was born, we have these things called Chinooks. And a Chinook is like this large warm mass of air that comes over the mountains. And so we would have, I mean, in Fahrenheit, of course, Canada uses Celsius, but in Fahrenheit, we could have a 50, 60 temperature degree swing in a day.
Wow.
Where it was like freezing when you woke up. And then by the time the afternoon is, like sun is shining, everything's melting. Yeah, we would have massive temperature swings.
That's so interesting. So we complain about how like leaving the house, not knowing if you need to bring like layers or whatever. You really had to like,
I'm just used to it. I always have layers, whether it's summer, because AC here is so cold to me. So I always have so many layers. Yeah, I was raised right in that respect.
Nice. I think layers are always good. Oh my gosh. Well, speaking of layers, we got a lot of layers to you and I cannot wait to get to all of them.
Yeah.
But first I want to ask you about what you've been up to this last year. I know a highlight was getting to go on the road and perform with Shania Twain.
Yeah.
How was that?
Like a dream come true.
Yeah.
I mean, as a little girl, Shania was the reason I started singing, you know? And so it's wild to be able, like, I remember watching her music videos when I was little and like learning all of her dance moves in the mirror and wanting to be her. And then fast forward a bunch of years later and I'm touring with her. It was just wild. I had to pinch myself so many moments. She's also the coolest. They say like never meet your heroes, and she's definitely the exception to that rule.
Yeah.
She is just so down to earth and so real, and like music and fashion, and she truly is like queen energy.
Yeah.
They just like everything just oozes out of her soul. It's pretty magical to be around.
I love hearing that story about meeting your idol and that like you really get to see goodness come out. I'm curious what you what your opinion as a fellow female I don't know what the female term for fellow is, but I'm just going to use fellow because
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
As another female country music artist and Canadian, what about, because I've heard you talk some about before how Shania broke the mold in many ways in those categories. What were some of those biggest ways that had an influence on you as a growing up woman, as a musician, and as a country musician coming from Canada?
Yeah, I think that's why she was a big inspo to me as well, because she just broke so many barriers, you know, from coming from like a small town in Canada called Timmins to being able to break some records that some musicians will never even like see in their lifetime is so inspiring. And as a female, I mean, watching a female artist stand in her power and like say the things she means, write songs about the things she means, be very courageous in a fashion sense so that you start a new trend and like really, really etch like who you are in the course of, you know, decades is so inspiring. I think, you know, all of the artists who I've been like fortunate enough to tour around and be around, like Keith Urban is another example, you know, coming from another country and really like making his way down here. And Shania was obviously OG in that category. It's scary. It's scary to move from a different country by yourself to a brand new country and you know nobody. I knew one person's name on a piece of paper when I first came to Nashville. And so I was like, well,
wow.
I guess now's as good as any the time to figure this out. So, it's important to have role models like that.
Who was that person? I mean, you don't have to say their name, but like, what was your relationship with that person that you knew?
A songwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And somebody, I went down to LA for 6 months before I came to Nashville, and somebody was like, you should check out Nashville. I think you'd like it there. And here is a friend of mine who is a writer there. And so I was like, cool, thanks. And so I called him up, and through that one guy, then I met like another writer and another writer. And when I first came to town, I would write triples every day.
What is that?
And so it means you write like three songs a day. So normal writing session starts at 10:30 or 11 and you write till 3 or 4 and then you're done for the day and you go home with a finished song. But when I first got to town, I knew nobody. And so I just wanted to meet everybody. And I just was like oozing with ideas. So I would get up and start my first song at 10. I would write with writers from like 10 till 2. Then I'd write another song from 3 till 6. Then I'd write another song from 7 till 10. Then I'd go to writers rounds after that and meet as many people as I could. Because I knew nobody. I was like, I was coming from a different country. And so I would go to these writers rounds and listen to these incredible songwriters who were up there just like playing, you know, these massive hit songs that you're like, that person wrote that song? That's wild. And I would go up to them afterwards and be like, hi, my name's Lindsay. Will you write a song with me? And if I wouldn't have done that, I don't think I would have really made like the special network that I did. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a few years after, got offered a publishing deal and a record deal. And now a decade later, I'm like zigzagging around the world.
Heck yeah. That's beautiful. I love how you shared about just the grit and tenacity you had. I mean, because a lot of artists I know wouldn't have the work all day and then go just walk up to these writers and be like, will you write with me? You know?
Yeah. It's wild. And I think when you're young, you just have a different level of tenacity and courage. I think you don't know as much about failing, or you know as much about
Know as much, and so you're a little bit more fearless.
Yeah.
In many ways, because
is the most beautiful thing ever.
Yes,
I still want to tap into that confidence sometimes, and I like try to channel my 20-year-old self, and I'm like, okay, what would my 20-year-old self do in this moment? Because I think that kind of fearlessness is really potent.
Fearlessness and also our ability, like the younger we were, our ability for fearlessness and faith, I think it's just like, it's great to be able to go back to those places. And I love that you mentioned that.
Yeah, I think it is too. And when I think about like my younger girl self, I also look at me as like a little sponge. And I was just so eager. I graduated high school a year early. And I just wanted to like get out on the road and play music and sign a record deal and become a rock star. And I just was like, I'm ready to do this. And I also think that there's a vulnerability there that can sometimes be taken advantage of in certain situations. Granted, the beautiful reason of your podcast of like, we're humans. And when sometimes like when that eagerness is taken into the wrong hands, things can get weird, you know, and shit could go awry pretty fast. And so, even just saying that, I like look back on my 20-year-old self or my 13-year-old self and be like, that little girl is so beautiful. And she's also so vulnerable in ways that like now, I guess 2020 is like everything in hindsight is 2020, but now looking back on that, I'm just like, oh my gosh, I just want to like wrap my arms around her and protect her.
Yeah. I can completely understand why. Well, not completely, because I'm going to hear more about that in just a second. But I know you in the past few years have gotten vulnerable with publicly with some things that you're healing from. And the first thing I want to ask you about is being diagnosed with an eating disorder. Acknowledging that. And when was that? How long ago was that?
It was about a year ago.
Wow.
It was pretty recent actually. And I never really saw it coming. I went through different kinds of trauma when I was a little girl that I feel like I never really dealt with. And then for a number of different reasons and being around emotional eaters when I was growing up and not learning how to sit with my feelings, I developed an eating disorder over really the past 20 years.
Right.
And it was just slowly
came to a head
in the back of my mind. And not me having an eating disorder was in the back of my mind, but me having this thing that was like always going like this was in the back of my mind. And I didn't know how to confront it. And so I would just use food or the lack of food to
control,
try to get a sense of control.
Yeah. What do you think was your first significant life experience that made an impact on a negative impact on you to take away your feeling that you had autonomy and control over yourself?
I was sexually assaulted when I was 13. And I was so young at that time, I don't think I really understood what happened. Mm. And yet, like, I didn't tell my parents for 7 years because I felt like did something wrong. And so I was really alone with that for a long time.
Yeah.
And then I was sexually assaulted again when I was 21. And it was shortly after I moved here. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so I was like, oh, well, this must be me then, if this happens twice. Like, this truly must be something within me. It must be my fault. And as I would, you know, read stories of other survivors, like Oprah is like so loving and generous with her story and with what she's been through. And I would read a lot of survivors went through like a few assaults, and it made me question like, why does this happen? Like, why does something that terrible happen to someone once, but twice? Like, what? And so it really caused me to like answer some significant questions and like seek therapy. And I've been lucky enough to be in like amazing therapy for the past 10 plus years or so.
Oh yeah. Shout out to therapy.
Yeah.
It
shout
works.
Out to therapy. But I also will say that therapy is like a never ending process.
That's right.
And it is like talking about layers. It is like a constant unravel. And I think from like that significant trauma when I was little, not knowing how to sit with my feelings and not knowing how to like sit with uncertainty in a level of, I don't like this feeling right now. And so I just wanted to mask it as, you know, I feel like the root of a lot of addictions are, you know, it's really complicated and hard to sit with our feelings and to sit with uncertainty or to sit with shame or to sit with guilt or to sit with all of these things that do not feel good. They feel terrible. And when you learn as a kid or a teenager growing up that you can numb yourself mm-hmm. or quiet that voice with other things, then of course, as a human, you're going to be like, cool, well, I'm just going to binge eat, or I'm going to starve myself, or I'm going to drink a lot, or I'm going to do these drugs. Like,
well, right. And in this specific case, talking about either emotional eating or restricting in its relation to food, I mean, I think everybody understands that drugs and alcohol, like that kind of thing, I think we all like know I'm pushing the limits of what I should be doing, mm-hmm. you know. But when it comes to food, this we're talking about one of our basic human needs here.
Yeah.
And we live in a society, at least in our lifetime, you know, where, right, like, I mean, thank God for body positivity now, right? But we still got body image shit that's got to be dealt with everywhere. And like socially and in the media. But I think so much that the dealing with food, the lack thereof, and what you're talking about, the relationship with food, the awareness it makes sense that you don't understand. If you didn't get to a place where it was so glaring that you had someone intervene, the message that I'm also dealt with a lot of that as a youngster, so I can say it myself as well, you know, the message that I received was, right, like when you're thinner, you're doing well, you get social reinforcement. If it's emotional eating or something that you're feeling a sense of control where you didn't have control, you don't think like, I've got this secret weapon, whatever. Like there's not, I mean, I think for most of us, it's not a, like this malicious or like devious thing. It's a very subconscious mm-hmm. coping tool that develops where we feel this sense of peace. And so why would we not return to something that's helping to equalize in here?
Totally. But it's false peace.
Oh, right. Right?
Like it's total facade of mm-hmm. peace. It's so temporary.
Yeah.
It's like the beautiful thing of peace is it's a place to come home to, but like a facade of peace, like the vice of alcohol or my previous relationship with food was really complicated. And you do bring up a good point. I mean, food is like so important for us as humans to like nourish our bodies. And it's like one of the things we need to live. And so that was really complicated because I was like, well, this is healthy for me. I should have it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, you know, when I learned emotional eating patterns when I was a kid, I think that's where I started thinking that binging was a safe way to deal with my emotions. I got diagnosed with anorexia subtype binge purge. And so it's a complicated ED because like there are times where I would binge so much mm-hmm. that I'm like, I can't possibly have anorexia, like I'm fine. And then I would feel like I ate so much that I would just starve myself mm-hmm. and I would not eat anything, or I would work out like insane amounts, like 4 or 5 hours a day. And I'm like, no, I'm just getting ready to go perform. Like it's fine, but it wasn't fine. And when you do that for decades of your life, you can do some significant harm to your
Absolutely.
Body. Like, not to get into all the medical
let's go there,
pieces of
sure.
it, but I got diagnosed with osteopenia shortly after my eating disorder, which basically means that your bones didn't fully develop when you were a teenager. And sometimes when you can starve yourself or not nourish yourself enough when you're a kid, like when you're a kid and when you're in your teens, it's a really important age to make sure you're getting all the nutrients you need to, because your body's growing and your bones are growing. And there's a certain level, I'm definitely not a doctor, but I am a huge health nut and I love researching this stuff. But there's a certain age where your bones just reach their density. Uh-huh. And it's like from that point forward, you're just kind of left with what you got.
Yep.
And if you undernourish yourself in your teenage years, your bones aren't going to get as dense. And so osteopenia is not osteoporosis, but it's like the step right before osteoporosis, and it means you're more susceptible to developing osteoporosis later on in your life.
Wow.
And so if there was anything that I needed even scientifically to be like, to kick me out of denial and to really address, okay, Lindsay, you need to look at this. Like this is not just, oh no, it's fine. I'm fine. I think the moment last year when I finally realized it's time for me to figure what else is going on here, I remember like sitting on my kitchen floor, like eating a bag of popcorn or something, which sounds like totally harmless. But I had eaten so much in my pantry that I had no control over like what I was putting into my mouth. And that had come off of a week of like me starving myself, or like, yeah, working out for 4 hours after I had one of those binge cycles. And I was like, I do not want to live like this.
Yeah.
Like, I do not want to live like this where something else has control over me with how I operate. And again, with food, it was so complicated because it's like, food is healthy and I'm such a health nut. So I would binge on like healthy things.
Right.
And so it was like, it's fine. This all has coconut sugar or something lame like that. But it's like, it still just had such a control over me to the point where I was really putting my body in some bad places. And I remember listening to a podcast, hearing this girl talk about her relationship with food and how dangerous it was. And I was like, whoa, that's me. And she had just discovered that she'd been diagnosed with an eating disorder. And so it caused me at least to book an appointment and get some help. And now I've been in specific eating therapy over the past year, and looking at my relationship now with food, like a year later, is significantly different to a year ago. It's like wild.
I can only imagine. And I want to ask you a number of things about this. First, because I love to, it's easy when we talk about like alcohol addiction, drug addiction, people for the most part, I feel like know, right? It's a very black and white. Like we know what that looks like. Most
every case is different, but
I think it's easier to,
right.
But when it's like other behavioral addictions, it is more difficult to spot. And I love to dive into this because I think it's important. You know, one of the reasons why I'm so grateful that you and so many other people come on sharing your story is because clearly we want to provide hope, right? So somebody else, just like you heard this other woman share about her experience, will be watching this and be like,
totally,
this is me. So when describing how something is an addiction, it's easier, I think, to say we're talking about it, problematic behavior that interferes with your quality of life repeatedly.
Yeah.
To your detriment and to that of those of your relationships. So how did that show up for you, you know, leading up to the diagnosis?
I think for a long period of time, like I say, I feel like I've had an eating disorder for 20 years and I just have been excusing it as other things, or basically sitting in denial that, no, I'm fine. I eat healthy. I'm fine. But when I realized that something had control over me more than I have control over myself, it was like that moment. I will never forget. I was like bawling on my kitchen floor, just like eating everything in my sight and then feeling like I needed to go work it all off. And I'm like, this is not healthy. I cannot sustain this. This is not sustainable.
So that's where I can so relate, because I've been there so many times where you are just overwhelmed with the guilt that like nothing else matters. You gotta go spend 5 hours in the gym. So were you having to like cancel something you were supposed to be doing with a friend or this or that? Like that was you're prioritizing the gym because of like making up for this bank of spending too much, quote unquote, money, right? Like in the, was it interfering with the things that you should or had wanted to stay committed to in other areas of your life?
I'm such a workaholic and I'm like the epitome of a three. So I would never cancel anything, but I would like,
when you say three, you mean Enneagram?
Yes.
I love it.
I'm just like, like you tell me how far to run, how fast to get there, and I will do better than that. And like, and so when all of that was happening, I wouldn't necessarily cancel my day, but I would cut in on my sleep.
Mm.
And I even remember, like, when I was in high school, I would wake up at like 4 or 5 in the morning, not going to bed at 8 p.m., like going to bed at like 11 or 12, waking up at 4 or 5 just so I could work out. Mm-hmm. And still when I moved to Nashville, I remember like I would be up so late because just of my job, and I would usually like spend time in the studio till pretty late. And then I would be up at 4 or 5 a.m. at a boot camp. Mm-hmm. And both of those things are beautiful if you can like give yourself time on the other end of the clock to like sleep. But I just didn't, I was like, I'm fine. I can function with no sleep. Which obviously is not sustainable either.
Right.
But yeah, I definitely cut into my sleep all the time for years, like years and years and years.
And that's huge when talking about the longevity, mm-hmm. quality of life. And it says so much to me about like, you know, how the healing probably has had to take place for you. You know, you show up as an individual if when unhealthy stuff comes in, like you will suffer before you make others suffer. And so to the point where when I ask you, how is this affecting your quality of life? You didn't even tell me it was my sleep. I was like, how is it interfering with your relationships? You weren't even thinking I was sacrificing my sleep. You're thinking like, well, you know, and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And we get to, no. It pushed into my time because mm-hmm. There's no way. So I just think, like, I identify so much with that because the first thing you go to is not even thinking about how it was stealing from these other areas of you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a wild thing. The craziest part to me was I was just in denial for so long that anything was wrong. Because I was like functioning perfectly. And it was like a really wide awakening to, oh, okay, maybe something is wrong here. And oh, so people have healthy relationships with food. Like I couldn't keep Oreos in my house because it was either I don't eat any of them or mm-hmm. I eat the entire box.
Absolutely.
Like I had no control over just eating a couple because I wanted a couple. It was like the minute I tasted that, I would eat the whole thing. Same with ice cream. Same with, I'm like such a sweet tooth. So anytime I would have something sweet, it would be like I would need to eat the whole thing.
Would
and
you
then
also,
I would need to starve myself.
Right.
Because I ate the whole thing.
Yeah. And
it
the,
was
shame,
like
the
not
shame and
healthy.
Guilt spiral is... Mm-hmm. Insanity, poisonous, it's toxic. I mean, it's like, it's so many things. And gosh, I know so many people can relate to this. I something you brought up, I want to go back to, but I want to ask you about being diagnosed. I feel like a lot of people, like you said, it started early in life for you, but your diagnosis came 20 years later. I feel like a lot of times it gets caught earlier. So, you know, being at a stage where you're successful in your career, you feel like you're, you know, an adult handling your shit, you know. Did you go through, well, actually, I know the answer to this, but did you go through a grief process of the bargaining, denial? Hold on, I have to look at these because I can never keep them. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance around... the year, the time that it took and being like, wait, I'm this, was it, were you 34, 33 when?
Yeah, I was 33 when I got diagnosed. And yeah, I know all about the 7 stages of grief, depending on where you look, there's a few more, but.
What are the 2 that I missed?
So I wrote a record called Heart Theory. My last record was all written about the 7 stages of grief.
Heck yeah.
And so I wrote like, the record in order of like the anger, the denial, the bargaining, the depression, the like all of the cycles and they don't always happen in a linear fashion, you know? But like finally being able to get to that final place of acceptance is not this like sunshine place, you know, it basically is awareness to all of the stages, knowing that all of the stages are going to rear their head at any given point, any given day again. It's just like awareness of what to address it as, not as this like feeling in the back of my mind that I needed to like quiet with something. Mm-hmm. Being able to actually look at it, like feel that and be like, oh, this is sadness. Mm-hmm. Like I'm sad. Or, oh, this is grief. Like I'm grieving something. Or, oh, this is anger. I am mad at this thing. And being able to even just go through that process of, okay, I have awareness now to this feeling whenever I feel it, and being able to like ask myself, what is that? And I just think after years of, you know, experiencing sexual assault when I was little and not like thinking I was okay, mm-hmm. and not addressing some of those feelings when I was really, really young, I just got so used to doing this.
Yes.
That it became just a knee-jerk reaction.
So let's talk about this, what you just motioned for the listener out there. And because
oh, yeah,
I want
right.
to dive
We're
into
on a
it.
Podcast.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people that are watching, but we also have a big listening audience. And so I'm glad that you went back to that, because I kind of want to tie that together. So many of us, in a similar situation, right? Like what you're describing typically can be traced directly back to messaging from childhood, adolescence of some sort, mm-hmm. That is either overt or, you know, nonverbal messaging that we get that, if you're not okay, fine, but just keep it inside. Don't let anybody see.
Yeah, I think when we think about our generation, and I mean specifically Gen Z, it's so amazing to see like so much openness mm-hmm. of like mental health on TikTok. And I just think the next generation coming up is just much more open about things. And even seeing, I was listening to like some 8-year-olds talk about like, oh yeah, I'm dyslexic. And I'm just like, this is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Like everybody's just talking about their feelings and their positions in life and what they're going through. Cause our parents' generation was taught, and it's not even their fault. They were just taught that everybody needs to look like we're perfect mm-hmm. and nothing is wrong and everybody looks beautiful and everybody's happy and we're just gonna continue life that way. Like mm-hmm. I remember going into church, it was like, everybody needs to be perfect. Like we're all happy and everything's great. And it's just like growing up in that kind of container, no wonder we have these yeah. mechanisms of ways to like drum down. Yeah, the whenever I say this, I'm like waving my hand by my ear. Like
right.
whenever we feel this anxiety, essentially is what mm-hmm. I feel. I feel this like this uncomfortable feeling within me, like swelling up. No wonder we're so good at like quieting it down with yeah. something, or numbing it with something, or averting our attention to something else, because like that's how we were raised.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you bring up church. I feel like, and this is not me by any means hating on spirituality or religion, I'm still very spiritual myself and have a strong faith. But, you know, just like many things in our lives, there's a lot of stuff that's wrong yeah. in every area and that can get better. I don't know. I'm going to pull a statistic out of my hat. But I feel like it's about 99% of people that I ask that same question about. There's a theme here. What was your childhood messaging around keeping problems, you know, like keeping it tight? Without fail, it always goes to the reel that plays that somebody talks about is always when we were at church with the church family, with the whatever. And I feel like that was where so much of the core messaging, where it came from, that where a lot of it started for us.
And I think like not diving into, you know, certain religions, because I think that whatever you feel led to nourish your heart on like what you believe, like do it. But when I look back on being raised in like a Catholic community, there were like so many rules of like what you could and what you couldn't do. And mm-hmm. you need to be viewed as this like this happy little child. And it's just not human. Like, it's just not the way I see the purpose of, like, what religion is supposed to be and what faith is supposed to be, of, like, filling our hearts with a sense of purpose and a sense of hope. That's not what church was to me when I was little. Mm. And it's why I don't go to church today. I have an incredible faith. Mm. I, like, pray every day. I meditate every day. Like, my faith is central to my entire life, but I don't connect that to a building anymore. Mm. And I think because when I was a kid, that was just so backwards.
I think that, that resonates with me so much. It's a resounding theme for so many people. Mm-hmm.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
So on a little bit of a different note, I'm curious regarding your healing process this past year. What are some of the rewards and some of the challenges that you've experienced?
I'll do challenges first because okay. I was like getting the hard stuff over
yeah.
with. Probably why I've had an eating disorder for 20 years, but the hard stuff is like the minute you feel that place of peace, or like I said previously, like once you feel that place of acceptance, it doesn't mean that you're like good now. It's like, cool, you're good for the rest of your life. Like you get triggered all the time as human beings going through the complicated lives that we are all living. Like we're good to get triggered by things all of the time, every day sometimes. And it's more just learning tools of what to do when you get triggered and hopefully so you can respond differently than you have in the past. And so the hardest thing has been that, like, I thought I would get to this place where I'm just good now. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, that's never going to happen.
There's no finish line to recovery.
There isn't. And if anything, recovery means, to me at least, it means like actually sitting in my feelings, which feels awful sometimes.
Yeah.
Like actually sitting in my feelings, like really sitting with sadness or anger or guilt, like does not feel nice. Mm-hmm. Like it's not fun. And so that's been the hardest part, is realizing that actually recovery to me means feeling things, which is difficult and hard. But some of the most beautiful aspects of it, like I never thought I would have a different relationship with food. I always thought that I would be an all or nothing person because I'm so all or nothing in the way that I do a lot of things in life. Mm. And again, this probably is not by accident, you know,
like same here.
we are beings of habit.
Yeah.
But I've been able to completely rewrite my relationship with food. I now like view food as like, I always would be told like it's fuel for your body. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm never gonna see it as that. Uh-huh. And through like doing significant ED recovery work and therapy and working with nutritionists and all of these kind of specialist therapists, like I've been able to, there's something called nutritional rehabilitation where you start to like eat all of the things that I would never let myself eat. And so for a few months,
did you walk through a shit ton of fear doing that?
Yeah. Cause it's like dancing with the devil that I felt like was going to hurt me. And for sure, I mean, we'll get to body image in a minute, but as an artist, the way I'm viewed on stage is like a very complicated part of my brain. And body image is like the last step in this eating disorder recovery process. If there ever is a last step, like you're always like bouncing back and forth. But in terms of like unraveling the onion, body image is like the last piece, which we can talk about in a minute. But yeah, nutritional rehabilitation is wild. You sort of eat all of the things that you... that, or I should speak for myself, like I was eating all the things that I told myself I couldn't eat. because it was going to make me fat, or because I was going to gain weight, or because it was not healthy for me. I mean, I just had so many food rules after, you know, being a woman growing up in an industry where your body is looked at from all angles, is photographed from all angles, is critiqued by strangers on the internet sitting behind keyboards that will say the meanest things. And so I was so conscious of my weight, and I would go from this diet to this diet to this diet to this diet to saying I'm paleo, no, now I'm keto, no, now I'm this, no, now I'm that. And I'm just like, God bless. Like, I know so many diets in my mind. I know like the calories in certain foods. I know the fat content in certain foods. Like, my brain is just overwhelmed with like a ridiculous amount of information that really doesn't mean a lot. Mm-hmm. And for me to learn like, oh, I can eat anything that I want and just see like how my body feels about it. Like, I can eat for a preference. I like didn't understand that because I was just so focused of, no, I need to eat this to look a certain way, to be viewed at a certain kind of way. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty wild few months of me eating anything I wanted. And I for sure was eating like crazy things that you probably shouldn't eat every single day, but it was part of that like nutritional rehabilitation of being mm-hmm. like, I can eat these things. And if I want to eat Oreos, I can eat Oreos every day if I want. And so it was really hard. And now, since going through that for about a year, I have such a different relationship with food, in the fact that like, if I want to have an ice cream sandwich, I will have one, mm-hmm. but I won't need to eat eight of them. Because before, I would never let myself eat them. And then the minute I had one, I would eat all eight in the box, because I would never let myself. And I would just say to myself, okay, well, I got to get it out of my system. Mm-hmm. And I got to like eat so many ice cream sandwiches so I feel sick, so that I don't want to eat them again.
Mm.
And this probably sounds crazy, like hearing all these things, but
no,
those
I was
are
literally
the kind
thinking,
of things that I
when
would
I,
say.
When I would emotionally eat, mine would, when I would eat the rest of the box of ice cream sandwiches, it would be because I'm believing a narrative of like, I'm not going to be able to eat these for, I know, but right. I already know this is punishment. I'm going to have to punish yeah. myself after this. So I'm going to eat all of these to make sure I enjoy every last possible
totally.
Bit of enjoyment.
I get it all out of my system so I can just like really savor it. And then I'm just never going to have ice cream sandwiches ever again.
Ever. Yeah.
And I'm like, that is not a human being thing. Like, should you eat ice cream sandwiches every day of your life? Probably not. But can I, if I really feel like it? And the strangest thing is, if you let yourself eat ice cream sandwiches every day, you're gonna eventually wake up and be like, I don't feel like an ice cream right. sandwich anymore. Like, yeah. I want an apple.
Uh-huh.
Like, eventually you're going to get to that point. So it was, yeah, it was really scary, but it's kind of wild since I've like let go of the reins of control on that, how I actually can listen to like what my body wants, which is so wild for me to even say that sentence, because I was not anywhere close to there a year ago.
It's beautiful. What is your fitness relationship with fitness gone from
yeah.
to?
I love working out. It's one of my, like when people ask, what's your hobby? Mm-hmm. I list all the things I do to work out, because I love it so much. And it like the dopamine or whatever. Yes. I don't even know enough about hormones to really understand what's going on in my body. But the way I feel after, you know, the runner's high after I run, yeah. I hate running, but I love a runner's high. The way I feel after working out just makes me feel so incredible that it's gotten me out of a lot of like dips of depression, or it's like rescued me in so many ways, which is also why I think I held on to it so tightly, and why I thought that, okay, well, this makes me feel so good, so doing
5 hours,
it is going to make me feel even better.
Right.
Like, does that sound like an addict or what?
It absolutely does. And I absolutely have been there.
And so it's just like, there's a point, it's everything in moderation. And I've really had to learn, oh, okay, working out for an hour is good. And it's been hard sometimes. I know that sounds crazy, but it's been hard, like, stopping at a certain time. So now I, like, I time myself if I'm going to the gym, or if I go to a workout class. Like, I would go to a workout class and then come home and work out for 3 more hours or something. Like,
of course.
It's almost like portion sizes with the way I work out now.
I'm curious to know if you have experienced this, because I did as well once I got some healthy balance to my fitness. That I would, for whatever reason, end up having to take some days off because I'd worked myself to the bone, working out too much. And then I'd go back, and inevitably my tank would just, like, over days, because I'm working out more than my body can repair itself.
Yeah.
So by doing what you're talking about, what I ended up noticing slowly but surely was that I was getting to show up for whatever workout that I was doing feeling like, I'm like, wait, this is new. I feel like fully recharged and refreshed regularly when I'm coming. And that was not new for me. And that wasn't a norm for me. Right. I was used to feeling like showing up to the gym being like, I've got to completely exhaust myself, and even being half exhausted already because I had done too much, hadn't had enough rest, and hadn't, you know, all those things.
Yeah.
So did you notice that too?
For sure. And if anything, I was working out so much because I wanted to stay a certain weight and I wanted to stay a certain size. And when you're working out that much, your body never has time to recover. And it again, I'm not a scientist, but like, I think it gets so used to this like stressful response that you actually aren't even getting what you want out of a workout. Like you aren't really getting what you get out of a rested workout. Mm-hmm. When you're working out from like a really sleep deprived state, or you're like working out 3-4 hours or whatever, if you're eating what The Rock eats, okay, like maybe you can work out that long because you have the energy to do it. But from my state where I was like starving myself and then working out, it wasn't even giving my body the effects that I wanted from that workout. So it was like counterintuitive, like completely counterintuitive.
Yeah. Oh gosh, it's so true. Well, so talking about the rewards, you mentioned developing tools, and we've talked about some of them. I'm curious, like today, when you feel triggered, but yeah, because it's gonna happen for the rest of our lives. What are some of the ways that you get triggered today, and what are the tools that you use to help navigate that?
Well, I get triggered by almost anything.
Yeah.
I mean, me feeling sad when I open up Instagram, trigger. Like, me feeling less about myself when I open up Instagram, triggered. If anything, I have really leaned into like a journaling practice.
Mm.
I've just tried to find other tools other than just overeating or emotionally eating or starving myself. And so really leaning into things like long walks with my dog, or listening to podcasts that inspire me, or like really filling my soul with art that I care about. Journaling and meditating has completely changed my life. It's this way of, there's this really amazing book for any artist specifically, but really anybody who has like creativity in their heart. It's called The Artist's Way. And she's amazing. This woman like wrote this book years ago, but so many people have talked about it. I mean, Elizabeth Gilbert like says a quote on the cover of this book because this book is so amazing.
Wow.
But she talks about this thing called morning pages. And I've been doing it like on and off for years, but only recently have I become like really militant about it, because not in a unhealthy militant way, but in a way of, yeah, I just feel like so much relief from it. And morning pages are, you wake up in the morning and you write 3 pages of just whatever's on your brain. You can be like, I don't want to write right now. I don't want to write right now. I don't want to write. You can write anything. I've just really leaned into it as this way for me to get all of the anxiety, the feeling that's like waving beside your brain, away. And then after I write all of that down, I type, because I type so much faster than I write. Yeah. So I like type 3 pages worth of things. And once I get all that out, I feel like there's this peace in my heart and there's a lot less anxiety just like circling around my brain. So that's been really, really helpful. And in a way, like morning pages are kind of like meditation, but I usually like write 3 pages and then I sit and meditate. And my meditation is so much more peaceful. It's so much more peaceful once I get out all of the thoughts of, well, but this and this and this, and I need to remember to do this, and I need to buy Hendrix this, and I need to call this person back, and what if this happens, and what if the world ends? And once I get all of that out and then I can sit with myself, it's been an amazing tool of like how I come back to myself. Really, all of these tools have been ways to learn of how to like come home to yourself. Yes. And how to sit with your own feelings and not be scared of them.
That is the perfect segue to what I wanted to lead back to when you were talking about the challenges over this past year of walking through feeling your feelings, and it's not fun. It doesn't feel good. The other side of it, though, what we would describe as I feel good or I feel happy before the healing occurred, right? Before dealing with our real emotions, how they are. How would you describe the difference is on the other side of letting yourself feel anger, sadness, depression, the icky things that we previously would numb out or not let us. How would you describe what it feels like now on the other side? Because it's always temporary. It's always temporary feeling,
yeah,
right? So when you get through to the other side, what is that reward like for you?
Yeah, if anything, like the feeling itself feels worse. I will just be brutally honest. Like feeling grief and like feeling anger is like, oh, this is awful, which is why I like numbed it for so long. Mm-hmm. So the feeling itself is worse, but after the fact, on the other side of the feeling, which you're right, like all of those feelings are temporary, you get a level of peace that is not as temporary as like numbing always was.
Yeah.
And there's like a deeper awareness or like a learned insight to who you are. And I feel like you get to like through every time you're triggered or through every emotion you feel, you get to learn like deeper layers of yourself, which is the greatest gift of living life I think there ever is. I think that the more we get to know ourselves, the more we get to learn like what makes us happy and what brings us joy and what surrounds us with love. And the more we get to design the lives of our dreams. And I know that sounds really meta and really like
not at all
dream world, but I think it's through feeling difficult emotions that we learn little like navigation points of like, oh, that stove was hot. Uh-huh. Maybe I shouldn't go there again. And oh, that person made me feel terrible. Maybe I shouldn't hang out with them. And it's like all of those little lessons that that I think like guide us along the path and help us learn how to attract what we want.
Absolutely. I love that you touched on all of that. So a couple things I want to speak to. So I got sober at 24. I didn't start therapy and doing a lot of like trauma work and all that stuff until I was 30 or 31. And it's been since then for me that I started doing a lot of things you're talking about, recognizing the negative emotions for what they are and recognizing and being aware that those are meant to be felt. The healthy thing is to acknowledge and sit in it. Mm-hmm. And through that, I was able to identify, I mean, I knew that I've been dealt with huge amounts of codependency my whole entire life. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how. There were ways that were unlocked for me. And so much of that was not understanding what true happiness was, not understanding what you were just talking about, what really makes me happy. It was, for me, it was through identifying and sitting through those different, the icky emotions, as we call them, that led me to being able to find out what that journey of what actually makes me happy.
Yeah.
As an adult, I could not have told, because if you had asked me in my 20s what made me happy, I would have told you what I thought you wanted to hear.
Yeah, it's so weird because, like, I've had, you know, boyfriends ask me, well, you don't know who you are. And it's like, I do know who I am. Like, I know who I am. I've just been conditioned to be this thing.
Yeah.
And no human being is a thing. But it's taken me a lot of time to figure out that process. And if anything, I think it boils down to me, like, seeing myself as worthy of being heard and, like, prioritizing my own voice over other people's. I grew up in, you know, like, Canada. We're, like, raised people pleasers, you know? It's, like, part of our culture or something. Yeah. We're, like, so friendly and I just loved being able to, like, if everybody else was happy, I was like, okay, cool, I'll be happy then. And it's been a huge pattern for me to become aware of that, like, people-pleasing part that I think really easily gets wound into addictions and our vices, because, again, we're just like,
it's sneaky.
Yeah. And we're, like, pointing energy outwards into, like, other people instead of, just because it's more comfortable than, like, pointing energy in here, because in here feels awful.
Yeah.
And so when I finally was like, oh, my voice is worthy of being heard. Oh, and my voice should be heard before I listen to all these other people telling me things. Interesting. Like, that whole concept took me a long time to even realize. And now I think it's the thing I need to work on most, like, in this very moment, is reminding myself that, like, that inner gut instinct is more valuable than anything else. Anything.
Heck yes, sister. Yeah. Oh, I mean, like, what a beautiful place to come to. And I mean, like, a year, so much happens in a year, but also, like, with what you've gone through, I feel like that you are oozing such healing, like, that you have just, I feel like you have attacked, in a good way, just put your all into this process of healing over this past year.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely attacked my numbing of it all, because I was like, this isn't serving me, and I want to see what's on the other side of that, because this doesn't feel good at all. And, you know, the recovery of it doesn't feel good either, but the ability to come back to myself is worth any kind of discomfort. And now I have glimpses of that. I will say it's not like that forever. It never will be. But the fact that I know how to navigate to come back to myself is, like, a gift that I will never, like, abandon again.
Yeah.
And I hope that, you know, anybody listening to this knows how to navigate back to themselves, or if they don't know how, that they're interested enough to learn how and to figure out all the things in their road that are like speed bumps slowing them down from that process, because it's so special. And, like, if I were to sit here and be like, I am healed, it would be such a fucking lie, because I'm not. I'm just, like, more aware of myself than I was a year ago. And that definitely has healing in it. Body image is something I still struggle with so much. In my industry, it's, like, left, right, and center of...
Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet. I'm curious, because it's, like, I hear so many people, and I've talked to so many people that talk about, like, you know, I've recovered, recovering is a lifelong process, yada, yada. I have to be aware now, social media, all this stuff. And we touch on body image in a, like, almost like because we have to. But I really am interested from your perspective as a public figure on stage, in the media, in the new, right? Like you said, mm-hmm. all the angles. And you have no control over it. Mm-hmm. I heard you say once, you were like, not even the people who are supposed to be taking pictures, like unprofessional photographers are taking pictures of me in the crowd.
I love that because I love playing shows. Like, playing shows on stage is my favorite thing to do on this planet.
Sure.
Like, nothing brings me more joy. And I want fans to take pictures because it's like part of the magic of a concert is being able to like capture this moment that makes you feel joy or something and being able to like revisit that moment. But sometimes, like, pictures are posted on social media that I look at myself and I'm like, oh my gosh, I hate that body. And I can still say that sentence because there are days I feel that still. Mm-hmm. And will that ever change? I hope so. You know, a year ago, I thought I could never keep a package of Oreos in my house, and now I can. Yeah. So I feel like there's hope. But do I love my body in every aspect, in every way? Like, Brene Brown is so brilliant and amazing, and I just love everything that comes out of her mouth. But she said she's like dangerously in love with her body, and I'm like, man, that's so cool. She's so cool. I want to feel that. I want to be dangerously in love with my body, but I'm not right now. And yet I'm like really open to learning more about that, and I'm a lot better than what I have been. I have been so bad that the minute I saw like any piece of skin like oozing out of or like coming out over
like
my
if your pants are tight and
I would freak out and I would like delete the picture or I would need to wear something different. I had a boyfriend, like an ex-boyfriend relationship, like, gosh, a while ago, and I remember sitting on the bed, and I was wearing like jeans that had holes in them, and my leg was like popping out of like one of the holes in my jeans, because when you sit cross-legged, that's what happens.
It pushes your flesh out.
And my boyfriend at the time was like, I can't believe your skin's coming out of your jeans, like, that's gross, you should get a different pair of jeans. And it like, I still, to this day, my whole body is like, ah!
I can't believe someone would say that. A, B, I'm so glad this person is your ex.
Me too. But it's like things like that, messages like that stay in our minds. And
absolutely.
No wonder, you know, as women, we feel, because some of my friends have been told the wildest things as, you know, artists being like put on a pedestal of this is the way you need to look or this is the way you need to perform, or comparing yourself to like model photoshopped images on Facebook or on Instagram or on all these places that are just so the fake version of what a human body should look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know all these things and I'm like trying to embrace my body and embrace my body image, but it's hard. It's a hard one.
Do you have any a top go-to like of how you cope? Like, cause right. So being triggered with, cause it's, I'm assuming, I'm not diagnosing you, but like most of us that are recovering from eating disorder also have body dysmorphia. So I'm assuming that
I would assume most humans on the planet even have like a little bit of it, because it's so fed to us of like, this is the car you want. This is the house you want. This is the body you want. This is the like cool, like, cuffed shirt you want. This, it's like fed to us every flipping second. And if anything, our phones are like programmed to learn us better and to feed us more of that shit. So it's like, it comes from every direction.
Absolutely. Having said that, on that note, do you have a go-to to help regulate when you feel dysregulated and triggered?
Yeah.
By body image stuff.
Yeah, the first thing I've done is stayed off social media for a while. You know, I want to be on social media because of my job and because mm-hmm. it's like a way for me to talk to fans, but I really need to manage how long I sit on it. And when I get into scrolling, I just get off of it. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really see any of my friends' updates on what's going on with their lives anymore because I go on social media to post what I want to post and then I get off. That's been really helpful. And then just like trying to love my body in ways of even saying affirmations mm-hmm. or trying to look at myself in the mirror and be like, I love my body. Mm-hmm. Even if like 2% of me believes it. Repetition, I think, is of those kind of exercises is so, so helpful. And if you can like stand in the mirror and be like, thank you, body, like thank you for bringing me through this life and bringing me through this day. Like I broke my foot a couple years ago and it is wild how much we take for granted, mm-hmm. how hard our body works every single day. And like all of the processes that your body's doing that you don't even know about, that if your body didn't do those processes, you'd be dead.
Yeah.
And so it's like being able to just show gratitude to my body and like speak it out loud, even if it's just to myself in the mirror, has been really, really healing.
Well, and I think that I love that practice too. Because even if you can't believe it, even if it's 1%, even if it's no percent,
mm-hmm. yeah,
it helps your brain recognize that there's a goal.
Totally.
And by acknowledging the goal, like it can move a little bit closer to it.
Yeah. And I remember reading in all of the amazing books I've read over the past few years, like your brain can't know the difference between saying, I want this or I don't want this. So when we say a whole bunch of negative things, our brain interprets it as truth.
Wow.
And when we say a bunch of positive things, our brain will interpret that. So it's like, be careful of how you talk, like saying, I hate my body or I don't want this body is so harmful compared to saying, I love my body or I'm working on this or I appreciate like, saying positive things is so, so important. Just mm-hmm. as like our bodies can interpret the difference between our hands hugging ourselves and somebody else hugging ourselves. Mm. And so like, even this sounds so weird. People are probably like, Lindsay's crazy. Like hugging yourself or like putting your arms around yourself. Like your body cannot interpret the difference between you hugging yourself and somebody else hugging you. And so I've just been really mindful of like trying to love myself more because I've been really bad at it over the past 20 years. And I think it's in how you talk to yourself, how you nourish yourself for sure. Like being able to be like, thank you, body. Like just gratitude is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So I wanna, we've talked about so many great things today and thank you so much for your vulnerability and just, you know, going through that. It's not easy to talk about, again, you know, like the hardships of your life and dive back into that. So I have so much gratitude to you. I wanna ask you, like for that person who has identified with your story, what would you leave as like a final word of encouragement for them?
I would say that regardless of where you are in your life right now, if you think something is impossible or you will never be able to change some aspect of yourself, I would really challenge that because I think that you can change whatever you want. And if there's a will, there's a way. And for anyone who thinks that they can't put a package of Oreos in their pantry or something, like you can, like you actually can. You just have to have faith in yourself to take the first step or to reach out and get some help.
Yes.
And like that help can look like so many different things, but you have to be able to take the awareness of the first step of, okay, maybe I need some help in this department. Who could help me with that?
Absolutely. And I just like to add that getting help, I think the best first step always is finding someone that you can trust and just get honest with them about what's going on in your life and telling them that you need help, and that even if they're not the one that's going to help you get help, to at least be accountable to them so that another human being knows that you're struggling.
Yeah.
And they're going to hold you accountable and ask you, like, hey, Lens,
totally.
Do you make a phone call yet?
Yeah.
Do you do that Google search?
I think our words and our stories have so much power.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, even just reaching out to a friend or like it can be literally anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But healing is possible.
Amen. Lastly, I want to ask about what you have coming up.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. And so tell us a little bit about it.
Oh my gosh. I'm working on so much new music. I'm so excited. I've had a lot of inspiration to write about the past year or so. And I've also went through this massive transition in my music career. I'm, you know, recording the music that I've wanted to record in a long, long time. And so I'll have some new music coming out in a few months. So it'll be like the tip of the iceberg with a new album and shows to come. We'll be like traveling a lot, playing some crazy shows and festivals this year. So it's going to be 2024 is going to be pretty amazing.
I'm excited. I can't wait to hear when your first Nashville show is going to come out. So I'll be there.
I will definitely let you know, Patrick.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you again for today. This has just been absolutely phenomenal. You are precious. Your story is precious. And so much healing to be had here. So thank you.
So true. Thank you.
And thanks to each and every one of you for tuning in, sticking around through the end of the episode. And I want to remind each and every one of you that it is never, ever too late to start loving yourself. And you're only ever one decision away from a completely different life.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.